Welcome to Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Peter Carey, whose latest novel is Jack Mags. Earlier novels include The Unusual Life of Tristan Smith and Oscar and Lucinda, which was recently turned into a film. I guess the place to start is with Jack Mags, but also The Unusual Life of Tristan Smith. In both books, you give new takes on old subjects. Some have compared Tristan Smith to Tristram Shandy, though others have used Tristan and Isolde. And Jack Mags, of course, is a different take on Dickens. Is there a method to your madness here?
There's more madness to the method, I think, in truth. I mean, I think the Tristram Shandy connection was not a really deeply considered one. And, you know, that's a book that influenced me a great deal earlier on in my life, and I probably chose the name Tristan for that reason. But I wasn't thinking too much about Tristram Shandy when I wrote the book. But this is a whole different matter, Jack Mags. I did think a lot about Dickens and Great Expectations.
How did you conceive it?
Well, it's not so embarrassing. I can say it easily now, I guess. Is it? I'd not read Great Expectations, and I'd had quite a lot of, for all the names Dickens had been, times Dickens had been evoked in terms of talking about my earlier work, I'd actually never really read him. And I was reading Edward Said, in fact, A Culture and Imperialism by a Swimming Pool in Jamaica. And I start to read about Great Expectations and Magwitch as this character who is cast out from his home, who is an Englishman who can only be an Englishman as long as he remains in this place of exile. If he comes back to England, he gets hung. And I started to think, reading about this, I thought, by God, this character really is my ancestor, Magwitch. And the thing about Australia is, well, everybody sort of knows, you know, it started as a penal colony. But I really believe that those early years of in the penal colony formed our character forever. And I've really wanted to write about convicts and convictism and so on. So I thought this might be a way into that. So when I got back to New York, I read Great Expectations. And, of course, was rewarded, as anyone would be, by finding a really, truly great novel. But secondly, I was very interested to read it. I mean, reading as an Australian, you still inhabit that English point of view. You still inhabit Pip's point of view. And when you get to Magwitch, he's this dark, dreadful other. But he's my ancestor, see? So my first thought was, yeah, well, Dickens gave this guy a bad rap. I'd like to fix that up, set things to right. But there was also another thing that I, apart from the sort of wild anger at Dickens for doing this to my guy, was... Actually, I figured that what Magwitch was doing was a very Australian sort of a thing. That this is, that he's been cast out of his mother land. He's suffered all sorts of privation, torture, presumably. He's been given a conditional pardon, so he can be free in Australia, even wealthy. But all he wants to do is return to England and live with and continue to raise a representative of the class that has oppressed him, Pip. And we still, that's us, still, to this day. People in Australia are still arguing about whether we can really still be a republic and sever our ties to the monarchy.
I keep thinking about a line that Mags goes, that he would rather be in the sewers of London than living in a mansion in Sydney.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a very peculiar thought.
Yeah, he says, I'd rather be a bad smell here than a friggin' rose in New South Wales, he says.
Taking a character who's a dark character and turning it around and making the character the protagonist, of course, has been done before. And I'm thinking of John Gardner's book, Grendel.
Mm-hmm.
And there are others, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Did that ever cross your mind?
Yes, but no one had done this before.
Right.
And even in terms of the way of taking this character, I mean, I haven't really taken the character. Jack Mags has a similar action or ambition to Magwitch's.
Andrew Reimer in the Sydney Morning Herald suggests that what you're writing is kind of an alternate history, the story of Oates and Mags rather than Dickens and Magwitch. So we go into an alternate universe and see a different Dickens and a different Magwitch.
Yeah, well, it is true that when I first started to think about writing it, I was going to use Dickens as a character, and Dickens and his character. But as I went along, I really just didn't want to be bothered with that. I was into my book by then, and I didn't want to be restricted, partly by respect in some weird way, the feeling of I can't really know what Dickens is. But at the same time, I'm already creating a sort of a parallel life for Dickens. And there's obviously a lot about Tobias Oates which is drawn from Dickens' character and drawn from Dickens' life. Indeed, the end date for this book, which is the 7th of May, 1837, is the day that Dickens' sister-in-law, Georgina Hogarth, died. And that parallels the death of Lizzie, who's Tobias Oates' sister-in-law in this book. So, I'm fooling around with that. But, I don't really expect most readers to be engaging with that too heavily. It was important for me in structuring the book.
Well, other characters do have a Dickensian ring, particularly Percy Buckle, the fish seller turned rich man.
Mm.
You did a lot of research, I would assume, because there's a great deal of detail in this book.
Yeah, it was very hard to start out to figure how I was in some sense going to take possession of London in this period. Really, what I have to do as the Australian is to colonize Britain or take, in some way, because I know in the end I'm going to have Londoners as readers and English people as readers, and I've got to write about this with enough confidence and authority and insight so they're going to buy my London. And that's a hard position to get into. And if you go to literature, it's no place to go, because all you're going to do is you're just going to be a thief and you're going to be regurgitating stuff that people already know. And I live in New York City, which might seem a really bad place to be to write this book, but it turned out to be a good one. My wife was the one who said to me, why don't you... There must have been a lot of American visitors to London in this period. And why don't you go to them? Because they're going to be writing to tell the folks back home what it really is like. And they're not going to write about it like Londoners. They're going to tell you everything they see. And that was a great gift that she gave me. And from the very opening of this book, when Jack arrives in London and everything seems very bright. Well, I would never have written that without the help of an American visitor who'd never seen any gaslight. And it didn't look dim to that visitor. It looked blindingly bright. So that was a big help. And also, I'm just sort of obsessive. And so, I was doing a reading at Black Oak.
Right.
And they said, would you like to take a book after your reading? And that was very nice. And I went poking around the second. And there was this rather dull-looking book published by Princeton University called The History of the British Post Office. So I thought, oh, well, all right. I didn't even look at it. But when I got home, this book had all the sizes and dimensions of British coaches in that period, which I was able to use. It had maps of the mail coaches, where they went, where they stopped. All this I used in this book, and it was just sort of obsession and luck.
Well, what about the life of a footman behind the scenes?
I think part of it is you do enough work, you feel that you can free to make things up. But one finds key things, like there's a description in the book when Jack Maggs gets himself hired as a footman, although he's never been a footman. And there's a description there, he has to learn to do his hair with soap and powder. And I found from it was a diary of somebody who'd been a footman in a country house. And so I thought, this is great stuff. So
you pulled that out.
But a lot of the stuff, in the end, you just feel you can invent, you read a lot and invent.
The abortion material, I assume that came from research, too.
Well, very hard to research abortion in the 19th century. I really didn't find too much. The notion that the pills that Ma Britton, I've even forgotten what they're called now, the pills she sells would be made from ergo, came from a woman I know in New York who's a midwife. And I really didn't get that from any other source. I couldn't find much.
You make a reference early on in the book to people called mudlarks.
Yeah.
And what were mudlarks?
Well, there's a great source for all this stuff. Oh, God, what's the writer's name? He wrote for the Morning Chronicle and wrote these wonderful books about London Labour and the London Poor, Mayhew. And so he has all of... Mudlarks were people who these young homeless kids, very poor, who scavenged on the mudflats of the Thames, often just for coal, which they'd, wash and sell.
I'm talking with Peter Carey, whose latest book is Jack Mags. One of your earlier books, Oscar and Lucinda, was recently turned into a film. I'd like to ask you a little bit about that, sure. Because it's still playing. Did you have anything to do with the film?
Not too much. I mean, Gillian Armstrong, the director, is a really old friend. We've known each other for 25 years. I admire her and like her. We had conversations from time to time. When they had an early draft of the screenplay, we met in Sydney, Laura Jones, the screenwriter, and Gillian and I. So I said, well, what do you want? Are you going to show it to me or what? And Laura said, you can ask questions. So I asked her what the first image was, and then what the second image was, and then what the third image was. And that was really enough. I thought that the way she'd broken the story and gone into it was really pretty good. I couldn't have imagined how to go about making the screenplay.
Well, the first half of the film, or the first portion of the film, fairly closely mirrors the first half of Oscar and Lucinda, but then toward the end it diverges.
Well, there's the divergence is really that the child, Miriam's child, is born and Lucinda comes and adopts this child,
which is not in the book at all.
Which is not in the book. So it's sort of like, well, there's problems when you're trying to raise money for a movie. And Oscar and Lucinda has what they call a little further south, a down ending.
Right.
And in fact, I have readers who love this book passionately, and at least 20 people have told me that they finished the book and hurled it across the room because they were so disappointed and angry at what I'd done to Oscar at the end. And in Hollywood, there were similar sort of pressures to soften this bleak ending. And I think that what they managed to do in the movie was really wonderful. And in no way sort of alters Oscar's fate, but that Lucinda adopting this little red-headed child, there's some sense of it's satisfying emotionally, and it's a little bit less bleak.
Well, you also never quite come back to the opening narrator either in the book.
Yep, that's true. You never come
in the book.
In the book, you never do. No.
Yeah.
No.
So there isn't. You don't get that sense of completion that you do get from the film.
I've now seen the film for various reasons 3 or 4 times, and it's interesting. The bit that I really like the best, the bit that moves me the most, is the bit that's not mine. That's the ending that they gave it.
The character of the father. Is that really based on Edmund Goss?
That's me. Edmund Goss's father, Philip Goss,
was the father, the marine biologist.
Goss, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think if I'd, I was looking for material at that time. I wanted to be a rebel who would end up as an Anglican, which is a hard thing to sort of figure out how you're going to do that. And in searching for sort of, Christian fundamentalist sects in London, in England at that time, I came across Father and Son, this wonderful book by Edmund Goss. I didn't know it was beloved of the English, that everybody, I just thought, well, here's some stuff, I can use. And a couple of scenes, little bits of the lie. So fortunately, I did it well enough so that I didn't get into a lot of trouble for having done that.
Well, Peter Carey, I'd like to talk a little bit more about your work in general and your life. You state at one point that you feel that the theme of abandonment plays through all your books. Mm. I'd like you to talk a little about that.
Yeah. I mean, I think it took me, I think, until, I mean, I'm 54 now, and it's only in the last few years I suddenly put together all these orphans in my book with my own personal life. At the age of 10, I grew up in a small country town in
Bacchus Marsh.
Bacchus Marsh, yeah. And then basically, if you had to sort of create an imaginary class line for the house, for the town, it was working class, lower middle class. The age of 10, my folks, for all very good reasons and a great personal sacrifice, send me to this very posh boarding school.
Well, where is Bacchus Marsh in relation to Sydney?
Oh, it's about 600 miles south. Bacchus Marsh is about 30 miles west of Melbourne, which is the southern So it's sitting down there at the bottom of that big continent. And anyway, they sent me off to this very posh boarding school. And to give you an idea of how posh it was, when Prince Charles went to Australia as a young man to be an assistant teacher, he went to Geelong Grammar. And so I left home at 10. I had to, well, effectively I left home. I mean, I had to learn to survive in this totally different cultural milieu. It was a boarding school. I was there for 7 years. And I thought that I was a happy camper. I got on with it. There didn't seem to be any other options in my life but to survive there. So I wasn't one of the kids that, you know, had, you know, was wept or was unhappy or tried to run away or any of those things. I sort of just totally got on with it. But years later, looking at my work, I see how time and time again, there are all these orphans and abandoned children. So I would have to figure that there is some connection there. I think my great good fortune, really, is that this abandonment, if it indeed can be spoken of so melodramatically, does mirror the trauma of my country.
Right.
And so I just could only say that I'm blessed that those two things should fit together so nicely.
At that point, when you were in that school, is that where you began gestating the idea of being a writer?
Oh, God, no, it would never have occurred to me to be a writer, and it wouldn't have occurred to me. I was going to be a scientist, I think. And to have even imagined meeting a writer would have been sort of a slightly strange idea. I went off to university to intend on being a scientist. I got there, and just imagine, you know, you've been in this all-male boarding school, you know, for 7 years, and suddenly you're at a campus when there are actually women and alcohol. So my first year was very exciting, and I didn't do very well at all, and I had to get a job in the following year. And I got a job in an advertising agency, and in the advertising agency, I really began my literary education, because I walk into this room, it's full of all these people really who are writing, and often writing short stories in the office, and certainly doing it at night, and talking about books, not really being very productive about what they're meant to be doing. And so suddenly, having read not only Dickens, you know, but, you know, no Dostoevsky, or you know, no Jane Austen, or no nothing, suddenly I'm reading As I Lay Dying, Faulkner. I'm reading Ulysses, you know, with Beckett and Kafka, and very excited about what I'm finding. And so I immediately decided, because they were writers, I could be a writer too.
Well, there wasn't much in the way of Australian literature that, at least that we would know of. Did you get that feeling? Because I know people from Canada, Margaret Atwood, would sometimes feel like the poor second cousin of the U.S. in that regard.
Yeah, well, we certainly were. I mean, Australia is full of self-doubt and self-loathing in all sorts of ways, and certainly in our primary sort of cultural relationship was with Britain. And the notion, we had Patrick White, you know, who was who was, you know, already a substantial figure, but the way one thought about Australia and Australian literature oneself was that it probably wasn't terribly good, and that the real world, I mean, this is the I think was, and to a small degree still is, our condition, you know, that the real world was elsewhere. It's why Australians are always very good at knowing what's happening anywhere else. They will, you know, you can sit down and talk about what was happening in Berkeley, and they might have a damn good idea. They travel a lot. They're very curious. They're very outward looking, and that's a positive thing. But it also comes from a lot of self doubt as well.
Well, would people in Sydney know what was happening in Perth, or would they just not care?
Oh, they wouldn't give a damn. They would not give a damn. No, and the people in Perth will never forget also that the rest of Australia was certainly prepared to abandon them in wartime and just regard that as an undefendable position. So,
well, you did become a writer. I first became aware of you through science fiction and fantasy through the book Illywacker.
Uh-huh. I'd never thought of that as a science fiction book, but many science fiction... I mean, it won a prize, I think, an Australian prize for science fiction, which I was really pleased about. I'd never read much science fiction until people started to compare my early short stories with science fiction in certain respects. And then I started to read a little, and then I was nourished by it. So it happened in a roundabout way.
Well, when you look at your work, do you see yourself falling into any particular category, any particular area?
Not Really? I mean, when I think about... actually, Jonathan Miller once said this about Oscar and Lucinda. I think it's the most flattering and wonderful thing. Well, firstly, he liked the book, so I was so pleased, pathetically pleased. But he said about Oscar and Lucinda, there was sort of like a science fiction of the past.
Right.
And I think that, for me, there's not really a great deal of difference between writing about the past or writing about a parallel present. Or, in the end, it is all made up.
Well, your books, you tend to write historical novels, but I don't see people talking about you that way.
Well, there's a few things that, you know, I mean, I wouldn't have, at the moment, actually for the first time in my life, I have two books. There are two books sitting here, both set in the 19th century. And the Oscar and Lucinda is there because by chance a movie has arrived just at the moment that Jack Maggs has come out. And I think I'm very fortunate because mostly what happened, I feel has happened with my writing, is I've written a book like Oscar and Lucinda, say. And people, you know, a certain number of people have enjoyed it. And then the next book I write is set in contemporary Sydney and is this bleak, dark present. And people get upset with me. So I lose each book. I've always thought I've lost half my readers. So for the first time now, I figure if somebody likes Oscar and Lucinda, they might like Jack Maggs too.
Well, you're married to a theater director. Mm. What role do you think she plays in terms of her knowledge of theater? When it comes to your books, I mean, does she read the books and
comments
like that?
Yeah, she's a really, really fine editor, and she's somebody that you can show an early draft to at a stage where really all you want is just a little pat on the back and to be told you're a genius, right through to later stage where she can work. You know, her comments about sentences are really wonderful, and her comments about characters are very insightful. So, so she helps in that way. I think sharing her life in the theatre as a theatre director and talking, you know, going to workshops, talking about work that she's doing, has probably affected my work considerably, I would say. It's probably affected the way, you know, I've seen characters within a scene, how I've seen them that have, like actors, you know, what's the character's objective in the scene to get to what? And my dialogue is more and more, I think, the surface sign or symptom of underlying conflicts, probably far more than it ever was before. And I think that's a result of spending a lot of time in the theatre and around the theatre.
Have you written plays?
One of the worst nights of my life was spent in the theatre in an endeavour which it was sort of like Springtime for Hitler, you know, if it had failed. I cannot tell you the level of shame that I experienced in my one venture into the theater.
So we can't expect Jack Maggs the musical to appear.
No, I think I'd take a lot of talking into that.
Well, I'd like to get back a little to your ideas about Australia and how you think it relates both to literature and to yourself. You keep saying that it treats itself shabbily and that goes back to the prison days. Mm. But there comes a certain point when a break must be made. I know that the United States always looked toward England, and then one day the U.S. woke up and said, hey, we're us. That hasn't happened there.
Yeah, well, the United States, you know, as I recall, there was actually a war.
Yeah, but didn't matter. The Federalists was still in love with England.
Yeah, but a war is a sort of seems to me, a definite sort of an act. We certainly never did that. Look, my grandfather, who was born in Australia, always called England home, and this is very common. We really, if you looked at, you know, the way Australians acted in Asia during the 50s, 60s, even 70s. Yeah, they acted like British imperialists, really. Nowadays, of course, Australians are rushing around Asia saying, well, we're really part of Asia too, and we're all Asians, guys. But I think we really did imagine ourselves to be British for a long, long, long time. I mean, I'm not talking about what's happening there right now, but I think I'm talking for a long, long period of our history in my life. And in order to do that, we have to sort of, you know, forget or dissociate ourselves totally from those convicts and that beginning. Because if we want to think about that at all, we have to be really mad. So we have to be totally disconnected from those people and that event in order to say any of those things. And yet, when I look at what we do and how we are and how our society is shaped, I see it's very shaped by, incredibly shaped by those events in little things and big things. I mean, I think it's probably now some of the very good things that come out of that. I mean, I think, you know, we had a very early, a very strong trade union movement. And, you know, we can have, you know, in present day, not now, but a prime minister who's a former trade union leader and doesn't believe in God. And I think that that's maybe not disconnected with those early days. We have also, we used to, this is also a used to story, but I can remember, yeah, in the 60s, even in the 70s, you'd occasionally see two men hail a taxi. And when the taxi stopped, one man would go and sit next to the driver and the other man in the back seat. Why was that happening? It's happening because they don't want the driver to feel embarrassed. They're embarrassed to be place him in a subservient position. They want to sit beside him as his mate, as his equal, so he won't feel bad doing that. And if you had arrived in Sydney in the 60s, and instead of getting beside the driver in the front seat, you'd got in the back, it would not be impossible to imagine the driver halfway into the city suddenly saying to you, "What's the matter, mate? Do I smell?"
Well, but this is strange, because what we have is a classless society in that sense, extolling the virtue of a class-driven society.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's filled with the most extraordinary contradictions.
Have you noticed an Australian literature arising since you've become a writer?
Oh, yes. I don't know. I think when you're in the middle of something yourself, it's terribly hard to see really what is happening. But from about the time Gough Whitlam, the Australian Labor Party Prime Minister, came to power in the 70s. At about that time, there was this great flourishing of Australian literature and so much interesting work being published and being published still.
You've been living in New York for several years and have said that you are not particularly interested in going back.
Well, if I said that, I was lying. I'm interested, but it's a very complicated issue, and a lot of this is to do with family. I think about Australia every day. I wouldn't mind tomorrow morning waking up in northern Queensland and knowing that I live there. I think I've sort of settled for realization that there's a sort of homesickness that I do feel. It's a sort of a rather sweet pain, and not unuseful to me as a writer. We get back there quite a bit, and we talk to our friends a lot.
I'm Richard Walensky, and I've been talking with Peter Carey, whose latest novel is Jack Mags.